session number 11963, Reel 6.
Captain Henderson, Reel 6. We were talking about your experiences during the period in and out of the line in the sector, particularly at Hooge, I think we were concentrating on. Now, you've described the situation. You said it was a hot sector and that you yourself were the happiest day in your life was the day you left. But
absolutely.
Did all this have an effect on you? Did you get very tired or stressed or anything while you were there?
No, I wouldn't say there was any stress. We were beginning to get acclimatized to war by that time. No, not particular stress. Only a desire to get out as soon as possible.
Well, did you have any trouble with people with either shell shock or their nerve going or at this stage in the war?
Oh, no, I don't think so. There were always people, of course, who were very nervous.
How could you tell? I mean,
because of their behaviour and what they said.
Such as? How would they behave? What would they say?
I've been in a trench and there's a chap start to shout for his mother. But what could you do? Get him down and keep him quiet. But that was the absence of what you might call manhood or whatever develops in one as one gets older. You had no sense of...
Was it your part of your job to try and cheer men up who you could tell were nervous?
Oh, yes. I was called in once or twice. Go and have a word with him. Go and have a word with him. He's shouting like hell there. It was one way. If they were shouting, they must be quiet because the Germans could probably hear what was happening. You know, you hadn't to give the Germans the least inclination that there's a mutiny going on.
So how would you shut them up quickly?
Hit them.
You'd actually strike them then?
Well, just put them to one side and let them see that you're going to give them a hiding when you weren't, of course. And that was the best way.
Do you mean you'd slap them or push them
slap
or punch
them? Yes,
them?
Yes.
And did that quieten them down?
Oh, yes. It paid you to do that.
Would it sometimes happen to a man who had been brave beforehand and then his nerve would go? Or was it people who were always nervous that went like that?
Oh, I don't think, I wouldn't like to say that a chap could go into the line and appear to be normal and a good soldier, then collapse. I've never found that. I think one could tell by everyday work who were the people who could be trusted and who couldn't be trusted.
How could you tell the difference? Do you see what I mean? Could you just explain to us what you were looking for in a good man and what you saw in a bad man that made you watch him?
Well, in the course of ordinary conversation, you would ask a chap or tell a chap to do this, that and the other. Then he would say, oh, but that's a dangerous job, that, and this sort of thing. Or can I have somebody with me in case anybody's hurt, you see? I think you had to make a note of these things and it give you a line on the people who, if a real shindy started, who would be the good people and who would be the bad. And it wasn't their fault, it was the way they were made, and you had to get over the way they were made. And I've seen some of the same people, they were damn good soldiers.
So people could get out of it, they'd get better, would they? Or would they?
Oh, yes, yes. A lot of them even pulled themselves together while the thing was going on. They seemed to build up to a terrific climate of fright, and then gradually see what we were doing. I was as frightened as they were, probably. But I knew what one had to get on with the job.
So you what you mean is you controlled your fear better?
Yes, yes. And I expected to be hit or killed just the same as they did. I knew what I was doing when these things took place.
So what helped you? I mean, if you were frightened inside, how did you... What sort of helped you to carry on, do you think?
Well, the knowledge that I couldn't do anything else than what I was doing.
So you were fairly fatalistic about it?
Fatalistic, yes. I'd seen too many men killed in my time, and this sort of thing, and badly wounded.
Was religion a help to you at all?
Well, I was quite a boy down the road here, and I'm still religious today.
But did it help you in the trenches, you know?
Oh, yes. Well, we had a padre. We had a padre, you know. And I was his bright blue-eyed boy who used to take services and whatnot.
But did it help you control your fear? That's what I'm after, do you see?
Yes, I should imagine. I will say yes. Insofar that the church had taught me to lead a clean life, that gave me strength to overcome what was going to happen in the army.
Now, did you believe in shell shock, either then early in 1915 or later on in the war? Did you know what shell shock was, or did you think it was real, or did you think it just happened to people who were weak, or what did you think?
Oh, it was real. Real, by Jove, I must say that, because in after times in the army, in the whole of the war, I was in bouts of shelling, which put the fear of God into you. And I was frightened. But I hope I never showed it.
But what about actual shell shock?
Shell shock? No, I don't think I was ever shell shocked.
But you believed it existed?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, I'd give. The first thing I'd say about these people is that it was the way they were made or the way they thought, different to me. And I had to allow for that in everything that happened.
So you thought that shell shock was something that happened to people who got a sort of weaker mental outlook?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. The shock of what was happening overcame their resistance of things
but
like that.
But you thought they had to be weaker to start with for it to affect them?
Yes, yeah.
Were there any early cases of shell shock, you know, in this early 1915, May, June, 15? Or was there not enough shelling to...
No. I shall miss 15 out, I think, because they were so new to the job, you see, it was impossible to judge.
So that came along later?
That came along later.
What about... were there any... During this period, any self-inflicted wounds or desertions? It's probably
never
unlikely.
Never a one.
Not through the whole of your army time, then?
No, I don't think so. No, I should say no. I was never concerned or ever knew of anybody who had self-inflicted wounds.
Now, you were in the line. You didn't make any attacks, did you, while you were at Hooge?
No.
So what about when you were... We've talked about the front line in quite a lot of detail now, but you said there were three stages, front, reserve and rest.
Yeah, that's right.
How did it differ when you were in reserve at Hooge?
Well, you didn't have any sentry duty to do. If you were in the third line, you were just there in case you were wanted. If you're in reserve, then you had certain things to do. And in the front line, you're the lads who are in front and looking at everything and report back if anything happens.
So what did you have to do in reserve? What were these jobs you had to do when you were reserved?
Well, in reserve was to get your lice out of your trousers and all sorts of things like that. Pay attention to your body. Get a damn good wash if you could.
What about working parties? Would you be on them?
You could be on working parties, wiring parties.
Not at Hooge, though, you said.
Eh?
At Hooge, I'm thinking of.
Yes. And it could be a wiring party, you know, or a listening party.
I thought you said they didn't do wiring and listening at Hooge.
Oh, no. You're still in Hooge, are you? Or the trenches were too near for anything like that.
So what would you do when you were in reserve at Hooge?
Oh, well, they'd pass the time away by some means or other. I'm not prepared to say exactly what they would do. I do know that during the day it would be a case of looking after your personal habits and this sort of thing, getting as clean as you could.
What about out at rest? Where would you go when you were at Hooge? What was your, do you remember which village or town you went to for your rest?
Oh, yes. You went to, what shall I say, if you're at Hooge. Well, I can tell you now. There was a place called St. John's Chapel. Now, you know there's a St. John's Chapel in Durham. The railway station there at one time. And the lads, when we came out of Hooge, we left Hooge one night and marched during the night and most of the day to St. John's Chapel. The next morning, all ranks stand to, equipment, everything, and marched back. And we went to Canada Huts, just this side of Dickey Bush. Straight away, we marched back to Hooge, but on the other side of the road. Because there was this, in fact, I just mentioned to you that I went into the signaler's cabin and heard them being advised that there was a green gas attack. And I went to see the Salvation Army people. So we didn't have much rest after Hooge even. Were always, once you were in the Ypres salient, it was very difficult to get out of it.
Would you ever get a chance to go to a Staminase or anything like that? When you were, out of the line?
A Staminase? Oh, yes. There was no ban on lads going to have a drink or anything like that.
Did you ever go to them?
Eh?
Did you ever visit the Staminase?
No, I never drank.
So what would you do to amuse yourself while you're out of
the
line?
Right, mainly, in fact, I sort of kept a little diary at one time, and about different places we'd been to, and this sort of thing, you know. And I used to write back to my school, and there is a complete record of my writings in the school library, wrote every fortnight and things like that, you know. Thank God I had the privilege of doing that, but I bore a charmed life, man.
So, when you were out of, that's how you spent most of your time. Now, are there any other things that you remember about your time at Hooge that you'd just like to fill in, or any stories you can remember?
We had sick people and this sort of thing, but that's ordinarily. And when the word came that we are leaving Hooge, I've never seen such a cheerful lot of British soldiers, because it was a hell's hole, really, you know.
And you'd been there in and out of the line, you reckon, for about 2 or 3 months?
That's right, yes. Yeah.
Did you always go to the same place at Hooge? Or you?
No, oh no, it was a matter of luck as to what part you got into, you know.
And how big an area would it be that you were in?
Oh, I should say half a mile front.
And you'd be at various parts along
various
there?
Various parts, that's right.
But in that sector, the Hooge sector?
It depended upon who relieved you. If they were a full-strength battalion, it was different to a battalion that was only at half-strength. All these things had to be taken into consideration.
So what happened then? You left Hooge, and you say you were all very pleased. What happened then?
Well, we were told to fall in, and we set off marching, and we marched through the night and most of the next day to get to a place called St. John's Chapel. which was always had a pleasing effect on some of the lads because they knew the St. John's Chapel in England, you know. And when we're all going to settle down for the night, word came that we had to kit everything on and back we had to go.
You mentioned, yes. But then what happened?
Then we went to a place called Canada Huts, this side of Dicky Bush. The Germans sent the gas over, but it was passed by the time we got barged back there, you see. We only went back as a reserve.
You didn't actually go back into the line?
Oh, no. And the next move we made was to come right down the British line to Messines, and these places, right back down to Armentières.
And that was a march?
That was a march, and we were in every part of the line, right down to Armentières. A month, or 3 weeks, or a fortnight, whatever they wanted.
Now, these were quieter sectors, weren't they?
Quieter sectors, yes. Anything between Hooge and Armentières was considered to be a holiday for the British troops.
And how long did this whole affair take, you know, the moving in and out of the line down to Armentières?
Well, I should imagine that's 15. I should imagine we had Christmas in Armentières, I remember. And then we continued towards Arras.
So you were at Hooge till about July, and then in and out,
yes,
moving up and down the line.
That's right.
Now, during this period, things were getting more solid, you know.
And
better organised.
That's right. Yeah.
Is this when you'd start to get hot food in the front line and things like that?
Yes. There was something invented, of course, was the meat ration in tins, tin meat rations. We started to get.
I thought you'd had bully beef before.
No, I mean a cooked meal in a tin.
The McConaughey's?
McConaughey's. John William McConaughey ran a monarchy on his own. That's what the lads used to sing.
And these were popular, you said before.
Oh, no doubt about it. You could open them and have a little bit of a fire and have a hot lunch. And the most enjoyable things to have, you know.
What were the were they good? I mean, were the ingredients decent?
Oh yes, very good, very good. I think he was worthy of mention, the McConaughey's.
Did you get any of the other tinned food like pork and beans coming in there?
We got tins of beans, with a little pork in, you know, a little tasting. But I think McConaughey's and Haynes beans was the nicest thing that ever the lads got.
Haynes's beans? That was the name, was it?
Haynes.
How do you spell it?
Well, it's German, Heinz, you know.
The Heinz beans?
Heinz beans, yes.
You actually got their beans?
Oh, yes, we did, yes, yeah. Yes.
And how else did life change in these quieter sectors? What was different about it? Not the same. What was different about life there from Hooge?
Well, life was different insofar that there was not the artillery fire. There was not the enfilade fire that you got at Hooge. You were subject to enfilade fire from your wings, you know. Whereas in these easier places, you were dead opposite the enemy, and they had to either fire rifles or shells, which you could probably hear, and it wasn't so bad as expecting something coming, you know, at Hooge. But Hooge was a nerve-wracking place.
So these other places were much quieter. Was this where you'd start doing things like patrolling that you mentioned?
Yes, we sent out patrols every night in these quieter places.
Did you ever go on a patrol?
Oh, yes.
Would you prepare for a patrol?
No special preparation. We took very lights, of course. One, sending up one, let's have a very light from you, you see, from behind. And three was to signify that you'd heard the Germans were coming up towards you. Things like that.
So, you just, what equipment would you take with you into no man's land?
Just a rifle. In those days, there wasn't much extra.
Well, there's often a lot of talk about improvised weapons, various sorts of bloodthirsty club and things.
Yes.
Did you ever use any of them?
I have known our people take hand grenades up if in case they were wanted, you know. But they would never throw them unless they had a target.
What about these clubs I was mentioning? The sort of, did you ever take that sort of thing?
The what?
Clubs and things. I mean, there's this picture that people had big clubs.
No. We went out on our tummies, on our bellies.
How would you get through the British wire?
Oh, well, there was a place made for you to get through. Yes. And besides, you knew all that before you set off. But the Germans didn't have any idea what was to them. I've gone out and bit fun occasionally.
Well, tell us about it. So you go out through the British wire, and then tell us about perhaps a patrol you remember where something happened.
Yes, we'd go out, say, 40 yards, 60 yards from our line, and we would know a hole or something like that, because it had been made, you know. And the people in the trenches, you could either do it by wire, you know, tugs on the wire and this sort of thing, or signaled by light. Mainly, there was wire could be pulled along the ground. And you asked them to send a light up and things like that. And you remained mum, except one night I remember being pulled in after we'd been out all night. The colonel says, "What do you think you were bloody well playing at with those very lights?" He says, what did you send those up for?" And one of the lads, being quite honest, he says, "Well, sir, we had a draw as to who could send a very light the highest." Things like that. And the colonel had a damn good laugh, you know. It was all done.
So you went out and you took up a position and then you just stayed there?
Just stayed there until it was going to break daylight, then you got back.
And that was a patrol to occupy a listening post?
A listening post, yes.
And what were you listening for, if you see what I mean?
A listening for what the Germans were going to do, probably. It was all a listening post, and you had to sort out your questions about what you'd done whilst you were out. And if there was anything to report about movements, you told the off-duty officer that you heard the Germans to your left, and they seem to be digging, or things like that.
That was just to go out to a static post and stay there. What about a reconnaissance patrol, where you actually went out to seek, perhaps even to the German wire? Did you ever go on those?
No, I never got to the German wire to get through. All I ever did was to go out on a listening party.
What about wiring parties? You'd have wiring parties
there.
Well,
yes.
What were they like? Were you ever on one of them?
Yes. The wiring was done by REs, mainly. Oh, yes. They had the wire, and they had special parties, which made it up beforehand and took it out over the top when it was dark. And we people in the trenches saw what they'd done, and if it wanted adjusting, we did it. But wiring...
Would you provide covering parties for them, for the Royal Engineers?
Oh, yes. We sort of that they always had a covering party.
And what was it? Could you explain what it was for us? Did you ever do it?
No, I don't think so. No.
What was it, though? Can you just explain what would happen?
Well, what would happen, of course, I had the security of the trench to get back into, and this sort of thing, and we would cover them. We had rifle parties who could fire whilst they were doing that.
Any other activities in No Man's Land that used to go on in these quieter sectors?
No, I don't think so.
Did you actually ever make a raid during 1915, you know?
Some of our people made raids. We sent an officer, and he would take his servant with him one night. All officers had servants, you know. And by Jove, we never saw the officer or the servant again. They walked right into the German line.
So that's it for No Man's Land, as far as you remember, in these quieter sectors.
That's right, yeah.
What about in the quieter sectors, was another difference that you'd get dugouts, proper dugouts?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, we scored there because in the 50th Northumbrian Division, we had a lot of miners. And if there's one thing the 50th Division were proud of, was their revetting, building, and the cleanliness of the trenches occupied by the division.
Well, how did they go? Well, that's not dugouts, but how we'll do that. How did they go about revetting? Do you remember? What sort of revetting were they so good at?
Building a back of a trench on the slope, taking it away from you, you know, like that. Brick and stone and soil.
They'd use that for the actual revetting?
Oh, absolutely.
Not wire or wood?
No. And they had the knowledge and the skill. They are miners. And you have no idea how nice some of the revetting looked.
What about the actual dugouts? Would every man get a dugout in
a
quiet sector?
There was a dugout, dependent upon the size, for four men, six men. Probably you could get 10 into some, 10.
And what did they look like?
Well, they were in the earth. And inside was purely earth too.
Did they go down or just in?
Straight ahead.
So they didn't go down?
No.
So, and which wall of the trench would they be in? Would they be in the German side or the British side?
The British side.
So the back of the trench?
Yes, the back of the trench, yes. Or quite a lot of people made dugouts in the communication trench. If you were wanting some extra accommodation, it was quite possible to go down the communication trench and holler out another one.
And how big would they be?
I should imagine to hold the six men at least to lie down.
So quite deep, quite a way back.
Oh yes. It depended upon what you could provide, of course, on the ground and on the walls, if you wanted to. But they always got something.
Was there anything to keep the roof up or to make it safer if a
shell... No. The boys did introduce various things, you know. There was plenty of trees to knock down if you wanted them or things like that. But it was a matter of personal effort, not official.
Did you realise that the dugouts weren't safe from a direct hit?
Oh, yes. It was cover.
It was cover from what? Was it cover from the weather or cover from shells?
No, cover for the weather.
So they weren't much different for a shell, except for shrapnel.
That's so. The shrapnel was part of the war. This was part of our effort to be comfortable.
Were there any other differences about life in these quieter sectors?
Well, yes. If you are going into Third Reserve, You were in little villages where you could get plenty to eat and plenty to drink if you're so inclined. The different parts of the France and Belgium and Holland, no, not Holland, it wasn't in the war, made life either bright or clouded. When we were at Messines, you could come back miles into the country and have estaminets and eating places and this sort of thing. Even at Camel Hill, you could get meals if you wanted them, whilst you were actually on duty.
In the third line?
Yeah, oh yeah.